The headlines. The Taliban says the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan after 20 years is a victory for the Afghans and a lesson for the invaders. More than 1 million homes and businesses in Louisiana remain without power one day after Hurricane Ida slammed into the U.S. state. And Australia's Canberra extends its hard lockdown by a further 2 weeks as the capital city struggles to contain a surge in the highly infectious Delta variant. Thanks for joining us. The top spokesman for the Taliban has called the withdrawal of U.S.-led foreign forces from Afghanistan a good lesson for invaders.
The withdrawal of foreign forces is a big achievement for the Afghans and their independence. It is the day of good lesson for the aggressors that they shouldn't have invaded Afghanistan.
Mujahid made the comments hours after the last U.S. troops left Afghanistan following 20 years of military presence. He said the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan has come to ensure security and protect the dignity of the people. Mujahid noted that the Taliban want to have good diplomatic relations with the world and the U.S. The group seized the Afghan capital in mid-August following a lightning advance against the government. Following that, tens of thousands of Afghans and foreigners flew out of the country through Kabul Airport to meet an August 31st departure deadline. Political commentator Tim Anderson says the withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan after 20 years of war marks a great defeat for the U.S.
I think it has decided to stop its direct occupation of Afghanistan, and it may well try and maintain its so-called prerogatives to send missile attacks, and I think it's very likely to maintain an economic blockade, or let's say extend the economic warfare, the economic siege measures that the US has against virtually all the independent countries in West Asia at the moment. I think it will do that as some sort of sour grapes. I remember when they withdrew from Vietnam, they had these economic siege measures on Vietnam for very many years. They're very bad losers, so I don't think they'll give up all their options or admit defeat, but I think that the direct occupation and all of the terrible outcomes of that and the regular bombing of civilians in Afghanistan, that I think has come to an end. There's been a great defeat for the US occupation there, and I believe it's going to flow on to other countries in the region too. I think that we'll pretty soon see US withdrawals from Iraq, Syria and Yemen, and that's certainly to be welcomed.
The UN Security Council has adopted a resolution calling on the Taliban to provide a safe passage for Afghans and foreign nationals who want to leave the country. The resolution, drafted by the U.S., Britain, and France, was passed with 13 votes in favor. China and Russia abstained. The measure, however, does not mention the creation of a safe zone, which had been requested by French President Emmanuel Macron. The resolution also calls on the Taliban to allow for safe and unhindered access for the UN and other agencies to provide humanitarian assistance. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says his country has suspended its diplomatic presence in the Afghan capital.
As of today, we've suspended our diplomatic presence in Kabul and transferred our operations to Doha, Qatar, which will soon be formally notified to Congress. Given the uncertain security environment and political situation in Afghanistan, it was the prudent step to take. 18 days ago,
Blinken was speaking after the U.S. military said it had completed its withdrawal from the country. He said that fewer than 200 Americans remain in Afghanistan who want to leave, and the U.S. will continue to try to get them out. The top American diplomat said that the Taliban would need to live up to their commitments to provide freedom of travel, respect the rights of women and minorities. He urged the Taliban to not allow Afghanistan to become a base for terrorism. U.S. drone strike has killed at least 10 civilians in Afghanistan. The U.S. claims its drone targeted a suspected suicide bomber in Kabul amid recent deadly attacks in the capital claimed by Daesh. Some Afghans describe such a U.S. raid as arbitrary. Others are urging the Taliban to form a government sooner to prevent chaos in the country.
Americans launched an airstrike in Jalalabad, And yesterday they did the same in Kabul and even confirmed that they had attacked ISIS. They do not have a legal license to carry out attacks in Afghanistan arbitrarily.
The United States was here for 20 years to serve Afghanistan, but all the infrastructure it built was temporary, not permanent. When Russia came here, it built buildings for the people and the government that still stands. But the Americans destroyed everything they built before leaving the country, just like the government they built here. A president fled before the United States left.
Our only demand from the Taliban forces is that they take control of the security of the city of Kabul so that such rocket incidents can be prevented. And they should form a government quickly so that the people of Afghanistan can leave easily.
We want the Islamic government to form their cabinet as soon as possible and for the Islamic government to start working in Afghanistan so that it can prevent this insecurity.
More than a million homes and businesses remain without power in the U.S. state of Louisiana after monster Hurricane Ida struck. The hurricane tore roofs from buildings and caused massive flooding. It downed trees and power lines, many of them still live in floodwaters. That caused a total power outage in the worst-hit city of New Orleans. The Category 4 storm killed two people and trapped scores of coastal residents under floodwaters. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has called the damage caused by Ida catastrophic. It's the strongest hurricane ever to hit Louisiana. It made landfall there on Sunday, bringing winds of 240 kilometers per hour. It weakened to a tropical depression Monday night. Australia has extended by 2 weeks a COVID lockdown in the capital Canberra to contain a surge in Delta variant cases. The lockdown began 3 weeks ago, however, daily COVID cases continue to rise in Canberra. On Tuesday, the city registered 13 new infections. The outbreak there is believed to have spread from New South Wales. That is the epicenter of the current Delta outbreak in Australia. On Tuesday, the southeastern state registered more than 1,100 new cases. Daily infections have been steadily rising despite lockdowns in the past several weeks. Authorities have kept restrictions in place as a vaccination rollout goes on slowly across the country. A group of climate activists have staged a sit-in protest in the British capital, London, bringing the traffic to a halt. Around 200 members of the Extinction Rebellion group blocked the Tower Bridge to protest against the government's investment in fossil fuels. They chose the location as it is in the vicinity of London's financial district. The group accuses the finance industry of funding climate change. Police made about a dozen arrests. The sit-in was part of the group's fifth wave of mass protests on environmental issues. Israeli forces have fired tear gas and live ammunition at Palestinians protesting near the buffer zone of the Gaza Strip against the years of Israeli seizure of the territory. Palestinian media say that several protesters were injured, three of them with live fire. Dozens of Palestinians have been wounded in anti-Israeli protests since Saturday. Demonstrators say that they will continue their protests until the regime lifts its crippling blockade on the people of Gaza. The territory has been under a tight Israeli air and sea blockade since 2007. Ashraf Shannon says Palestinians believe that Israel will continue its atrocities against Gazans with the backing of some Arab states that have normalized ties with Tel Aviv.
The Palestinians here believe that such Israeli attacks will continue because of the support Tel Aviv receives from Arab countries, mainly in the Persian Gulf region, who have been normalizing ties and have normalized ties with the Israeli regime and also opened embassies in both Tel Aviv and the Emirates. Palestinians feel stabbed in the back, not only by Arabs in the Persian Gulf region, but also for years, the Egyptians on the southernmost step of Gaza have been helping the Israeli regime by keeping a proxy blockade of the enclave.
Four Syrian soldiers have been killed and 15 others wounded after terrorists targeted security checkpoints in the southern city of Deraa. Syrian media reported that the terrorists also targeted some residential neighborhoods in the city, injuring civilians, including a child and her mother. The attacks undermined a Russian-brokered truce agreement that allowed some militants to leave the city for northern Syria. The Syrian army later responded by targeting terrorist hideouts in several areas with missile launchers. Muhammad Ali earlier joined us from Damascus and gave us more details about the situation in the southern Assyrian city of Daraa.
The terrorist groups inside Daraa al-Balad and in other parts of Daraa countryside never stopped attacking the Syrian army positions and checkpoints since 2018. But let's speak about this period of time. In the past 2 months, there have been negotiations between the Syrian army and the terrorist groups over here. What happened was that 2 days ago, the so-called Central Negotiations Committee, which represents the various terrorist groups in Daraa al-Balad, announced the collapse of negotiations and started attacking both civilian areas in government-held parts of Daraa and also Syrian army checkpoints. Today, those terrorists attacked Syrian army checkpoints, killing four Syrian army soldiers and injuring 15 others, and they also attacked with mortar shells various parts of Daraa, also injuring and killing civilians. Now, for 2 days, in the past 2 days, they have been attacking those areas. And what the Syrian army is doing, despite the fact that the army can launch a wide military offensive and eliminate the presence of those terrorists, but because there are civilians, what the Syrian army is trying to do is to reach a deal without a military solution, peacefully end the presence of terrorists.
The International Organization for Migration says Yemen is facing a dire humanitarian crisis in the world, and nearly 15.4 million Yemenis lack access to safe water and sanitation. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more.
The International Organization for Migration says Yemen is suffering from the world's worst humanitarian crisis, as more than 15 million Yemenis have no access to safe water and sanitation. The organization maintained it reached 2.1 million of those in need of water and hygiene services.
The war and the siege on Yemen have had a significant impact on the water infrastructure and led to the destruction of a large number of water facilities and sewage treatment plants in Yemen. There are actually a large number of Yemenis who do not have access to clean water, but not at this scale.
Health officials say lack of access to sanitation is the main reason for the spread of cholera that killed thousands of Yemenis, including children, since its outbreak in 2016. They said the new figures herald a new wave of cholera if the international organizations keep turning a blind eye to the catastrophic situation in Yemen.
There are many water and sanitation projects which have been suspended, either partially or completely, as a result of the war and siege imposed on our country. Most of the organizations do not remain committed to their pledges. The UNICEF is supposed to provide clean water to Yemenis to prevent from a new wave of cholera epidemic and other diseases such as dengue fever and malaria.
Saudi Arabia, along with its regional allies, launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015 and imposed an all-out blockade on the war-torn country. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst man-made humanitarian crisis.
Millions of Yemenis, including children, are at risk of facing a new wave of cholera since they are unable to reach safe water. This has taken place amid the silence of the international organizations. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana.
In Pakistan, dozens of people have come together to mark International Day of the Victims of Enforced Disappearances. According to figures released by human rights groups, over 8,000 people have been abducted by intelligence agencies under the pretext of the war on terror. Mohammad Turi has more from Karachi.
Fury raging in the streets of Pakistan on the International Day of Enforced Disappearances that originated in military dictatorship, but the practice continued in subsequent civilian governments.
Victims' families are outraged at Khan administration's inaction over what they call the state kidnapping. Their only request from the government is to prosecute their loved ones in the court of law and follow the due process if they have breached any law.
The protest was organized by Human Rights Commission of Pakistan.
Today we are here in front of the Karachi Press Club. As you know, all from all nations, people are here in different regions of Pakistan. They are demanding for the safe release of their loved ones. I am also a victim of enforced disappearance. My father has been kidnapped by the secret forces when he was on his duty.
First post 9/11 reported cases of enforced disappearances was Dr. Afia Siddiqui, who was kidnapped along with her three children in 2003 from the streets of Karachi by CIA with the help of local secret services.
We arrange combined march, united march, along with Shia missing persons, Sindhi missing persons, Baloch missing persons, Pakhtun missing persons. Victim families are sitting here outside the governor house, and they are demanding that if someone is guilty, then give him a trial, fair and free trial in the courts of Pakistan.
We, the Sindhi and the Baloch and the Shia missing persons, Pashtun missing persons are protesting here. We held a march from Gora Kabristan to here, Governor House. We are demanding here from the Riyasat that where are our people, where are our workers, where are our nationalists, who are belong with some kind of parties.
Enforced disappearances is a chronic human rights violation in Pakistan, with more than 7,000 complaints of enforced disappearances since 2011. Where the real number might be much higher than the official figure. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are going to continue discussing Imam Khomeini's testament. In this episode, you will be listening to the Imam's viewpoints on the duties of the lawmakers and the responsibility of the nation and the body for vetting the qualification of lawmakers, guardian council, toward parliamentarian elections. Stay tuned, please.
Thank you.
Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, with much care, scrutinizes the role of Parliament in the country and writes in his testament, among the important affairs is the commitment of the members of the Islamic Council Assembly. We saw what calamitous damages Islam and Iran suffered from the unrighteous and deviated parliament since the post-constitutional era till the era of the criminal Pahlavi regime, and worse and more dangerous than any time during this imposed corrupt regime, and what destructive catastrophes and damages were inflicted on the country and nation by these worthless and servile criminals. During these 50 years, a bogus, deviated minority against an innocent majority caused Britain and the Soviet Union, and recently the U.S., to do whatever they wish through these very deviants and drag the country to decadence and destruction. Since the post-constitutional era, the important clauses of the Constitution had never been put into effect. Before Reza Khan, this was due to the Vestoxicated and a handful of Khans and land feudalists, and during the Pahlavi era, by the bloodthirsty regime and its lackeys and vassals. Imam Khomeini continues in his testament, now with God's grace and the effort of the grand nation, the country's fate has been put in people's hands, and the lawmakers are from the people and have entered the parliament with their election without the intervention of governments and Khans of regions. And we hope that with their commitment to Islam and the country's interest, any deviation would be prevented. I recommend to the nation for the present time and future, with their firm resolve and commitment to the Islamic laws and the interests of the country, in every round of parliamentary and election, send lawmakers who are devoted to Islam and the Islamic Republic, which are mostly among the middle and deprived classes of society and not deviated from the right path toward the West or the East, and have no inclination toward deviated schools, but rather educated persons and aware of the affairs of the time and Islamic policies. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, writes in his testament, now that, thank God, the barriers have been removed and the free space has been created for involvement of all classes, no excuse remains, and it is among the great unforgivable sins to be insouciant toward the affairs of Muslims. Everyone should be at the service of Islam and the country to the extent of his ability and influence to seriously prevent the penetration of the adherents of the two colonialist poles, the Vestoxicated or Istoxicated and the deviants from the great school of Islam. And they should know that the opponents of Islam and the Islamic countries, which are the very international plundering superpowers, gradually and subtly infiltrate in our country and Islamic countries and drag these countries to the trap of exploitation by the persons of the same nations. Then the Imam, addressing the ulema and the sources of emulation, writes, and I recommend the respectable clergy community, especially the great sources of emulation, not to keep aloof from the affairs of society, particularly the presidential and parliamentary elections, and not to be indifferent. All of you saw, and the future generation will hear, that the hands of players of politics, following the East and the West, set aside the ulema who had founded the constitutional movement with much effort. While the ulema too were fooled by players of politics and considered involvement in the affairs of the country and Muslims as out of their position. Thus, they gave the sin to the West Oxicated and let the constitutional movement, the constitution itself, and the country to sustain damages which need long time to compensate. Imam Khomeini continues in his testament, "I ask and recommend the respectable Guardian Council, either in the present generation or the next ones, to fulfill their Islamic and national duties with full care and power and not to be impacted by any power, and with no consideration to prevent the laws that are opposed to the pure religion and the constitution. And I ask the members of the Islamic Council Assembly Parliament in the present era and the next eras that, if God forbid, some deviated elements with conspiracies in political play impose their membership unto the people, the assembly should reject their credentials and not let a sabotaging affiliated element enter the parliament. The Imam also, addressing the religious minorities, writes, I recommend the official religious minorities to take a lesson from the eras of the Pahlavi regime and choose their MPs from among the persons who are committed to their religion and the Islamic Republic and not affiliated to world-devouring powers and have no inclination to atheist and deviated schools.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to the Spotlight. Tehran has issued a warning to the U.S. against blocking Iranian fuel shipments to Lebanon. It is said that the U.S. is in no position to block Iran's legitimate trade with other countries. Now, this is while Lebanon is suffering from an economic crisis and shortages amid American sanctions. Why is the U.S. keen on blocking fuel, which is so key in running people's lives and the economy there in that country? Is the U.S. putting its illegal sanctions and maximum pressure policy on Iran before human lives, namely Lebanese lives? Does it have better options for Lebanon? Let's find out more about this first from Mariam Saleh, who's our correspondent joining us from Beirut. Mariam, at this point, tell us about the delivery process as a whole, what stage this is at from in terms of Iran's fuel going to Lebanon.
Well, the thing we are waiting for is basically a statement made by Hezbollah. We are waiting for an official statement, whether from Hezbollah or an official statement being declared by Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah himself, because he himself said in the last few speeches, and one of them, he stressed that no matter what reports you get coming out on when Hezbollah or whether Hezbollah will be bringing in shipments of fuels from Iran, you have to wait to hear it from Hezbollah directly or from me directly. So that is what something that we are all waiting for. Even reports coming out whether the ship has reached the Mediterranean or not is still not accurate, because with issues like these, Hezbollah and even Iran tend to work on things very secretively country because of issues related to the threats. And don't forget, Hezbollah Secretary General stressed in his speeches that he considered this ship since from the moment it ship sail from Iran, it will be considered Lebanese territory. And he then warned, of course, the Israelis and the U.S. if they try to target this ship in any way, that Hezbollah would have the right and the resistance would have the right to retaliate. Now, of course, this in itself, when you hear the talk here in Lebanon, whether in newspapers, analysis, and so on, what is more significant than the timing of the arrival, it is the decision itself of bringing in fuel into Iran. That in itself proves that Hezbollah has made a strategic decision. It is a strategic resistance in itself, whether in the fact that it has defended Lebanon from Israeli occupation, Israeli invasions, from the Takfiri terrorists, and now from the U.S. sanctions. Of course, the resistance, which is legitimately recognized by Lebanon state, by Lebanon's government, this is something the Americans have been trying to remove from the cabinet's manifesto for years. This remains in the government's manifesto, giving Hezbollah the right to resist not only occupation and Takfiri and terrorist threats. Now they are facing very clearly U.S. sanctions, and we should be hearing, I think, in the upcoming days, perhaps something about the whereabouts of this ship and when it will be arriving in Lebanon.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Maryam Saleh there from Beirut, our correspondent. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Activist and political commentator Leif Maruf joins us from Beirut. We also have journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, who joins us from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. And Elijah Magnier, let me first start with you. Tehran is saying that the U.S. and other countries are really not in any position to actually dictate to Iran the legitimate fuel trade that Iran wants to pursue with, in this case, Lebanon. Why do you think the U.S. is so keen on Iran actually not delivering fuel to Lebanon?
Thank you for having me. Well, first of all, the U.S. cannot intercept or stop the delivery of Iranian oil to any country in the world, and we saw that when Iran delivered to Venezuela. Secondly, what the U.S. would like to see is Iran refraining from supplying Lebanon with oil because it has been putting pressure indirectly on the Lebanese government and imposing some sanctions without saying it on anything that can help Lebanon to come out of its internal dear crisis. And by providing Lebanon with oil and diesel, it means that the pressure will be partially lifted, because I don't think Iran is capable of supplying all the needs of the country. However, it is capable to make sure that the hospitals are functioning, the bakeries are functioning, and all the medical supply, and wherever they the first necessity for survival can be responded by this Iranian oil. And this is what the U.S. doesn't want, because the U.S. is targeting the axis of the resistance and mainly Hezbollah to prevent Hezbollah from gaining more popularity and to turn the population against Hezbollah domestically by saying, if you disarm Hezbollah, if you respond to our request to sort out your maritime problem with Israel, then the situation can return to its normality.
Interesting. We're going to break this down. Go ahead. I thought you were done there. Elijah, go ahead.
Yes, I said what's happening today is the counter effect. What the Americans are trying is to squeeze Hezbollah and to embarrass it and to turn the population against it. And it turned out now if Hezbollah supplies the Iranian oil and diesel to the Lebanese population and mainly to the hospitals, that will increase Hezbollah's popularity. So it's turning the embarrassment and the sanctions and the threat, Hezbollah is turning it into an opportunity to show to the population that is the U.S. behind the sanction, mainly when the U.S. ambassador to Lebanon said, well, now we can allow Egypt to deliver Lebanon gas and oil, and then without asking the opinion of Syria, when Syria is under the Caesar Act and harsh EU and U.S. sanctions. So All that indicates what the Americans are doing in the country, preventing the country from recovering.
Okay, I'm curious. We're going to break down some of that, hopefully, with both of you, because you made a lot of good points there, Elijah. But let's look at the situation in the way that the Lebanese see it. Iran wants to deliver fuel. The country needs fuel badly. They're suffering from this crisis that has been years in the making, and they see the U.S. placing sanctions. Of course, Iran is under sanctions also. But Iran says, Lebanon wants fuel, we're going to give it to them. We're not going to listen to the U.S. Do you think that the Lebanese see that as a bad thing, that Iran wants to deliver fuel, and in essence, aside from Iran looking at Hezbollah in a negative light because of its association with Iran?
Well, actually, there has been surveys of Lebanese people in the last few days, weeks, about the exchange of oil with Iran, and the vast majority of Lebanese people say they want the Iranian oil and they would like to use it if it's available in the market. The other thing is that we saw multiple representatives of parties and or supposedly sects in Lebanon that are supportive of America or its vessels in the region coming out and breaking the line and saying that they are ready to support and are waiting for the arrival of Iranian oil. And so we saw one representative of the Kataeb party, a right-wing Christian nationalist party that usually is funded by Saudi-occupied Arabia and the United States and other vessels. One of their representatives came out and said that he stands for the arrival of the Iranian shipments of diesel and gasoline because the Lebanese people, including his community, are suffering under these unreasonable conditions. Similarly, we saw a Sunni sheikh, imam of a mosque, come out in his Friday prayers, in his Friday sermon, telling his congregation that he supports what Hezbollah is doing and wishes that the Iranian oil arrives. So in reality, the people in Lebanon, like people around the world, not only here, would take any product if it's arrived to their market in a good and fair pricing. And the United States and its vessels in the region have been strangling Lebanon and other members of the Axis of Resistance through these economic wars. You know, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen are countries of fertile lands that have all the resources they need to survive, but are not allowed to access those resources and or are not allowed to conduct trade to maintain their basic needs in this country.
Okay, and that is something which is a point that as well the Secretary General has made, and we're going to get to that point also. Now, let's talk about, if we can, Elijah, about the U.S. Ambassador to Lebanon, Dorothy Shea. I mean, there's a lot of question marks about her conduct in Lebanon. But first off, this offer that she said the Biden administration has made to help Lebanon get Egyptian gas after a speech by Hezbollah's Secretary General, this offer was made, which it appears that it's not going to be something that's doable. Tell us more about how it is that the U.S. is making offers that is not going to remedy the situation, first of all, in terms of it being executed on a timely fashion, and second, for it to not be doable at all. Why would the U.S. make such kind of offers?
That's a very good question. First of all, it was a reaction rather than an offer. The Americans, as soon as they heard what Said Nasrallah said, the first reaction is, well, we also can offer something to Lebanon. And the answer came from Hezbollah, you are most welcome to offer anything to the country, because Hezbollah has no intention to become a state or to supply what they need. And the supply what the country needs is very difficult to Hezbollah to fulfill. So if the Americans are honest about their offer, which is not, because they've said that about supplying electricity from Jordan and from Egypt to Iraq to make sure that the Iranians are not supplying the electricity to the southern Iraq, and they've done nothing so far supply Lebanon with the Jordanian and Egyptian gas or whatever energy resources they want to, that takes months or even a year to do so, and it requires an agreement with Syria that is lacking. So the Americans are first not serious. Second, they're showing that they are behind the sanctions and the suffering of Lebanon, and they even don't care. They are completely numb about the American University of Beirut Medical Center that stopped the ventilator, and I'm sure Hezbollah would be very happy to supply the American Medical Center in Lebanon with enough gasoline to boost their needs and to be able to supply the services they do to their patients when the Americans are failing. And the American embassy in Beirut is behaving not like an embassy, but like an empire in a small country, dictating whatever they want over the Lebanese government. They're preventing Russia and China from moving in, not only Iranian oil. So for the Lebanese now, even those who are pro-Americans, it's very obvious what the Americans are doing. And as your guest rightly said, today, those who are with Hezbollah or not, who are against Hezbollah, they would be extremely happy to receive the Iranian oil, and I think that will change their mind to point out who is really the enemy and who is really behind their suffering.
Well, this is a point here, Laith Maarouf, that we need to discuss. Based on a humanitarian perspective, it's very hard, if any, to find statements that are coming from the U.S. that point to the dire humanitarian situation, which needs urgent attention. The fuel is going to remedy some of the problems that Lebanon has. But we don't hear that. What we're hearing instead, and even by some media, is that Lebanon shouldn't purchase the oil from Iran because Iran is under sanctions, and Lebanon, whose economy, even though it's in a meltdown phase, where they're going to have sanctions imposed on them for doing this act. But you don't hear about people's lives being in danger, hospitals not functioning properly, fuel that is such urgent need. This overlooking, oversight by the U.S., if you can tell us about that, and whether the Lebanese actually see that in that respect.
Well, Ambassador Shia definitely overplayed her hand. She may be recalled because of the mess that she created. This sanctions and economic war on Lebanon have played into the hand of the resistance. And all her plans have failed. And in fact, right now, you know, in the last speech of Sayyid Nasrallah, he said that he will continue to bring in gasoline and oil products from Iran. He will be also filling in the gap that in any situation the state is not delivering on its duties to the people. So that's an open-ended situation. Any place where the state fails to deliver on its services that are required, Hezbollah will fill them until the state actually delivers on its duties here in Lebanon. One point to talk about in terms of the gas and electricity that the American ambassador promised is the fact that Egypt doesn't have enough gas to export. It barely has enough for its own market. And what that means is that the Palestinian gas that is looted from the sea or off Gaza by apartheid Israel, which is connected to the pipelines in Sinai and in Egypt, and then is connected to Jordan, is what will feed, supposedly, the Lebanese market. And so here we have an imagination so wild, you know, far by this ambassador to think that Syria will allow apartheid Israel to sell its gas through its own territory, and or that Hezbollah in Lebanon and other parties in Lebanon will allow that exchange to happen. And similarly with electricity, Jordan doesn't have an extra amount of electricity that could feed Lebanon, but it is connected to the electric grid of apartheid Israel, and that means that any connection through Jordan of electricity again will mean that it's business with apartheid Israel. So these are delusional plans, and what we will see in the next few days is Hezbollah and the resistance in Lebanon setting facts on the ground that will change the face of the trade in the whole region as they open these pathways to Iran.
Okay. Well, Iran's position, as you're well aware, Elijah, and I'm going to quote the foreign ministry who spoke and said that the U.S. is not in a position to block legitimate trade. We're very serious, Iran has said, about exercising our sovereignty, and everyone should know that legitimate trade in this sphere is one of the basic principles of international law. The foreign ministry spokesman saying that today, and Iran has said on a number of occasions now that it's going to go ahead with its oil delivery to Lebanon. How do you see the fact that Iran is repeating itself? Do you think that it's getting word that the U.S. Is going to do something, or the elephant in the room here, which we haven't talked about, is Israel, whether they may react to Iran's delivery of gasoline to Lebanon?
I don't think the Americans are going to react, because Hezbollah said the ship is going to be considered as a Lebanese territory. And that message is directed to the U.S. and to the Israelis, which means if there is any obstacle that is going to face, then Israel is going to pay the price. And if Israel attacks the oil tanker, then Hezbollah knows how to balance terror and deterrence equation by preparing a supersonic precision surface-to-surface missile and hit back by hitting the Israeli oil rigs or harbor of Haifa. Therefore, I don't think the Israelis are going to do anything foolish, but even if they have the habit of violating the international laws and intercepting ships in international waters. But I think this time the Israelis know perfectly well how this is going to cost and how much is going to cost and how painful is going to be on Israel if they start this war with Hezbollah. And this is why I think Hezbollah is above this.
Okay. Leith Maruf, one of the other messages this delivery by Iran to Lebanon sends is the fact that it's breaking U.S. sanctions, so to speak. Of course, sanctions that are deemed to be illegal, aside from the fact that this is also a humanitarian effort by Iran in some respects. This breaking of U.S. sanctions is something that we saw happen with Venezuela also. Is Iran actually showing the world that U.S. sanctions, in this case in point, are being broken, but on good grounds, and therefore it sets a trend, and that is something that angers the U.S.?
Yes, because right now we see that the symbolism of breaking the sanctions on Venezuela, on Syria, and now on Lebanon is also clearly points out to the United States not being able to enforce its will on these other actors on the global scene. So what has does that mean? That means that the power of the United States is waning, and it cannot deliver on threats. That's what sanctions depend on. The sanctions depend on being able to threaten others to comply with their will on who's going to be having trade and who's going to have the basic needs of survival and life in their country. And, you know, I am very in agreement with my colleague here that it's very unlikely that apartheid Israel and the United States will attack the shipments coming from Iran. But you never know. We have here an empire in retreat. It knows that it's collapsing. We have apartheid Israel that knows that if the empire leaves Afghanistan by today and tomorrow, by the end of the year, Iraq, and leave Syria, that means it's going to be left alone with the useless vessels of the Gulf that cannot defend themselves against Ansarullah in Yemen. So these are actors that are backed into a corner. So we have to, you know, there is a very small possibility that they will act irrationally. And as we saw that happened in Palestine 2 months ago, the acts of attacking the mosque during Ramadan, the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, and the attacks on Gaza are all irrational acts. And could it be calculated that somebody in the leadership of apartheid Israel would act these ways? And so now we have to wait in the next few days to find out if the tanker arrives in Lebanon. And if it does, then that means a beginning of a new era in the region, because this will be the first of many boats that will break all those fake borders between the countries of the region.
Okay, I have time for another question, but under a minute, Elijah, if you can, and I'm almost sure I anticipate what your answer is going to be. Israel, according to sources, Israeli sources, that is, has said that the resistance movement is on alert to react to any hostile move by the Israeli regime against this tanker after entering the Mediterranean. Do you think that Israel will commit a miscalculation?
Now, first of all, I don't think the oil tankers will reach the Lebanese coast. I think they will reach the Syrian coast to lift the embarrassment to the Lebanese government. And from Syria, they will cross to Lebanon. Secondly, I really strongly believe that Israel is not going to dare to attack the oil tanker because Hezbollah is extremely serious in the retaliation, because it's a matter of survival for the entire Lebanese population. And Hezbollah today is acting on behalf of the Lebanese government that is incapable to stand against Israel and defend its right to receive gasoline from any country in the world, except especially when the country is in need of this gasoline.
Thank you so much for that. Let me thank our guests. At the top of the spotlight, we had Mayab Saleh, our correspondent from Beirut. Activist and political commentator Leith Maruf also spoke to us from Beirut, and journalist political analyst Elijah Magnier from Brussels. It's goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال علي عليه السلام إن الله سبحانه فرض في أموال الأغنياء أقوات الفقراء فما جاع فقير إلا بما متع به غني والله تعالى سائلهم عن ذلك.
Imam Ali said, Allah the Glorified has fixed the livelihood of the destitute in the wealth of the rich. Consequently, whenever a destitute remains hungry, it is because some rich person has denied him his share. Allah the Sublime will question them about it. Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, one of the things which we learn from the truly universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is the fact that the world is a temporary living space and that its worth is not as much as we believe. Dear friends, it is well known and it has been recorded in the history books as well as the books of tradition that Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, O world, know that your life is short, your worth is little, and your pleasure is transient. Dear friends, when Imam Ali alayhi salam talks about the world, he's talking about the materialistic aspect of the world, these clothes and cars and wealth and status and money and treasures and position and power and these kind of materialistic things, all of these things which are related to the materialistic, the carnal aspect of this world. Imam Ali alayhi salam here reminds all of us that life, first of all, is very short. We think that 50, 60, 70, 80 years is a long time. But when we reach that age of 50, 60, and 70, and we look back at our past, we realize that time has flown by. Isn't it the famous statement of Prophet Nuh, peace and blessings upon him, Noah, who lived for thousands of years, and what was said when they asked him how long you lived, he said, a day and a half.